If you pay attention to the way in which the church year works, you'll notice that there are times, by design, that the church year kind of picks up speed and then slows down, all so that we might be able to better understand our faith and be strengthened in our understanding of Christ and his mission in the world. We see that most markedly, for instance, in the season of Easter, when the life of the church picks up dramatically on Ash Wednesday and then begins to accentuate and to become louder and louder like a crescendo until the catharsis of Easter. There's a reason for that. That was a way of teaching faith and converting people. In the ancient days, what would happen is you would take the converts, the people who wanted to unite with the church, and you would basically throw them in head first into the life of the church, and they would have to fake it until they make it, right? They would be thrown into almsgiving, into prayer, into fasting, into scripture study. They would be taught for 40 days and 40 nights the language of the faith so that they might have a touchstone when they related their experiences to one another. And then late, on the Saturday before Easter, they would come and they would be baptized, many of them not knowing what would happen. Then they would be fed milk and honey as a sign that they were being taken into the new Israel, into the promised land, the church. And there they would spend the night hearing salvation history from Genesis until Revelation, until they celebrated the glorious feast of Easter. Now, it has always been true that those celebrations build, and then there's a crescendo, and then there's a huge catharsis. And then on that Sunday after Easter, it was a time that they called the Low Sunday. It was a time that they began a practice of mystagogy. The crowds had fallen away, the faithful remnant remained, and they engaged, as I said, in mystagogy, which means to be led or guided through a mystery. And for 7 Sundays, a week of Sundays, the people of faith would meditate upon what does the resurrection of Christ mean for our lives. Now, if you look, you can see the same pattern happens also around the church's celebration of Christmas. The life of the church, while it kind of picks up speed in the beginning of the program year in September, it doesn't really get its stride until about mid-November. Then we're off at a sprint. And the life of the church grows and grows and grows until the 24th. And then on the Sunday after Christmas, we have another Low Sunday, a time when we gather for mystagogy, a time when we chew on the mystery of God poured out in human flesh. And that's why on these Low Sundays, you'll inevitably find that the texts that we hear are texts from Jesus' childhood. And they're texts that oftentimes trouble us for one of two reasons. Either they present Jesus in a light that is all too human, or they confuse us because they have Jesus doing things that are really divine that we don't understand. See, that's an ancient mystery. They call it the communicatio idiomatum, the communication of attributes. It's the question of how can this one Jesus of Nazareth be fully human and fully divine at the same time? Now, we don't know a lot about Jesus' childhood from the scriptures. If we start with Mark, say, the earliest gospel, if you read Mark, you're going to begin with a long lineage that is going to take you from Abraham to King David and eventually to the birth of Jesus, and that's it. But we do learn two interesting tidbits from Jesus' life and his family life and what it meant for God to be poured out in human form in Mark. The first one is kind of interesting. At one point during Jesus' early Galilean ministry, he's saying things and doing things that are setting people's teeth on edge. The local religious authorities are up in arms, and his family decides to have an intervention. They're going to stop him before he gets into trouble. And Mark tells us that Jesus' brothers and Jesus' sisters showed up to help extricate him from a very sticky situation. Now, we don't necessarily think of Jesus as being born into the same kind of families that we're born into, with siblings and sibling rivalries and all those things that happen in the course of human life. But the scriptures tell us quite plainly that Jesus was fully clothed in humanity and experienced what we did. There's something else that surprises modern readers in Mark, too. The ancients took this kind of as a par for the course, and that is that if you read in Mark the list of the disciples, you're going to find a disciple named Thomas, Thomas Didymus. Didymus wasn't his last name. It wasn't his surname. Say, hey, Thomas, no, call me Mr. Didymus. Didymus was a title. It meant twin. The understanding of the ancient church was that the disciple Thomas was actually Jesus' twin. What does it mean to have a Messiah who is so fully poured out in humanity that he himself could have a twin and share life in the most unique of ways with humanity? In Matthew, we don't learn too much about Jesus' early life. Matthew begins with the visit of the Magi, this nod to the fact that the message of Israel and its prophecies and its hopes would be shared with the greater world. But Matthew does something important. Matthew understands Jesus and his early life in the light of Moses. We'll hear this next week about the visit of the Magi. Generally, the Sunday after Christmas is when you hear about the slaughter of the holy innocents. And that is when Herod is tipped off that a king is born. He will stop at nothing to quell this threat to his throne. And so they calculate about how old this Messiah should be. They say 2. And so he has his soldiers slaughter the children, the males, under 2. In the course of that, the angel Gabriel appears to the Holy Family, and they tell Mary and Joseph, go, take this child and flee. Flee to the land of slavery, to the land of Goshen. And they do. They go to Egypt, and then they return. In this gospel, Jesus is presented in the most Jewish of ways as the new Moses, the one who will eventually give the Sermon on the Mount, come down from the mountain, and give a new law, a law of love. What does it mean that Israel's hopes should be so fully realized in this birth, Jesus, the Messiah? Now, John, far from telling us any infancy stories that we might recognize, talks about Jesus' pre-infancy. In John, you have that beautiful prologue, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was God, and the Word was with God, and through him all things came into being. That's generally the text that is reserved for the day of Christmas itself, the 25th. And it's a nod to this mystery. What does it mean that this most ancient of one, this cosmic one, is poured out in the life of Jesus of Nazareth? Now, if you want to hear some pretty interesting infancy narratives, there's a fifth gospel that's floating out there that biblical scholars use, often in conjunction with the four canonical ones. And that's the Gospel of Thomas. It's written by and for a heretical sect of Christians called the Gnostics, and it's close enough to the Gospels that we have, but it has some strange things in there. Two of them are infancy narratives. The first one is a narrative where Jesus is playing outside making mud pies, and his mother Mary is watching him. He's fashioning them into doves, and then when it's time for him to come in, he raises his arms, and the doves fly away. The other one is when he's being bullied, and he manages to throw the bully off the roof, kills the bully. The bully's laying in the street. His friends are saying, you're really going to get into trouble now. He's like, no problem. He goes down to the street, resurrects the bully, and ostensibly is never bullied again. What does it mean to have a Messiah who so shares our life that he is bullied and deals with the same kind of human situations that we share with, but yet is so fully divine that he can animate doves from mud? And then we get to Luke. Luke tells us an extended narrative of Jesus' early life, the Annunciation to Mary and his birth. It tells us that shortly after he was born, Mary and Joseph did what good Jewish families did. They went to Jerusalem, and there they offered back to God a sacrifice of 2 doves. When Jesus, even as an infant, is recognized there by Simeon and Anna, 2 prophets that have been waiting, they cry out in song because they recognize that this is a holy child, the one for whom they've been waiting. Then they go home, and they eventually come back to celebrate the Passover. Now, I want you to hear early narrative from Jesus' infancy from the Gospel of Luke, the second chapter, and I want you to hear it and try to pick out what mysterious words are placed into this, because the evangelist Luke is doing something very specific. He's teeing up a mystery. There's going to be some code words you're going to hear. The Gospel according to St. Luke, the second chapter. Now every year his parents went to Jerusalem for the festival of the Passover. And when he was 12 years old, they went up as usual for the festival. When the festival was ended and they started to return, the boy Jesus stayed behind in Jerusalem. But his parents did not know it. Assuming that he was with a group of travelers, they went a day's journey. Then they started to look for him among their relatives and friends. When they did not find him, they returned to Jerusalem to search for him. After 3 days, they found him in the temple, sitting among the teachers, listening to them and asking them questions. And all who heard him were amazed at his understanding and his answers. When his parents saw him, they were astonished, and his mother said to him, "Child, why have you treated us like this? Look, your father and I have been searching for you in great anxiety." Then he said to them, "Why were you searching for me? Did you not know that I must be in my father's house?" But they did not understand what he said to them. Then he went down with them and came to Nazareth and was obedient to them. His mother treasured all these things in her heart. And Jesus increased in wisdom and in years and in divine and human favor. Do you pick up the code words in there? Yet, of course, the Passover. That's a nod to what will eventually happen. Jesus will return to Jerusalem to celebrate the Passover with his 12 disciples. The number 12 is in there also when Jesus was 12 years old. When he will go to celebrate that meal with the new Israel, representatives of the new 12 tribes. There's the sign of Jonah. After his mother and his father travel a day's journey, just like the two unnamed disciples will at the end of the gospel after the resurrection, and Jesus will reveal himself on the road to Emmaus, they realize he's not there. They head back, and they search for 3 days. And then they find him in the temple. And Mary does what any good mother would do. "What do you think you're doing? You know what you've done? You've caused us a lot of pain and harm. Why were you here?" And then Jesus says something very cryptic that no one understands. "Of course, why didn't you think I would be here in my father's house?" And the end of this gospel lesson ends with the same ending of the narrative of the birth itself. Mary, while not understanding all of the things that Jesus does, nevertheless holds them in her heart. So, as 2018 ends and a new year begins, I can't think of a better way to begin a new year than to hold and to treasure the mystery of the Incarnation, the mystery of God Emmanuel, God with us, in our hearts. Amen.